This week on Lucky Paper Radio, I am very excited to share our exclusive Strixhaven preview card with you. Evergreen, Disruptor of Global Capitalism. This is 6 mana for a legendary artifact vehicle. It's a 6/9 with crew 4 and has, as long as Evergreen, Disruptor of Global Capitalism is a creature, if an opponent would draw a card, instead they investigate. And Evergreen, Disruptor of Global Capitalism can block any number of creatures. Thank you so much to Wizards of the Coast for this preview card. Looks like it's really going to disrupt Standard. Hello, 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 and welcome to Lucky Paper Radio. I'm your host, Andy, and I'm here with my co-host, Anthony. Never looks at the top card after he decides to mulligan Maddox. Is that true, Anthony? I seem to recall that you never look at the top card and take a peek and see if you actually needed to mull.
I wish I was that strong. That's definitely not true. I think that I've gotten to a good place of always looking, but really being aware that it just doesn't matter and it isn't real data. But you gotta look, right?
I mean, it is real data. It's just nowhere near enough real data to make any kind of conclusion from it.
Sure.
We can't be gatekeeping data here, Anthony.
I think definitely earlier in my Magic experience, I could have looked at the top card and you know, been really disappointed when it was exactly what I needed. So let's just say I'm in a better place.
I'm getting caught up on Constructed Resources, the partner podcast to Limited Resources, of course, our arch rival podcast. And they had a great episode on mulliganing a couple weeks ago, which I thought was interesting because maybe we'll do an episode on mulliganing in Cube at some point in the future, Anthony. But one point they made very clear at the beginning of this episode was that really the entirety of their mulligan decision conversation was all about Constructed, because they were basically saying, like, the bar to mulliganing in Limited is so high that you like have to have a completely unkeepable hand to even consider mulliganing in Limited because of how much unfavored you are once you mull a hand. And I was wondering, do you think in the average Cube, mulligans are more like Constructed mulligans or more like Limited mulligans?
I think, unfortunately, my answer is going to be a little bit wishy-washy and just have to say that, like so many other aspects of Cube, it falls somewhere in between.
Context!
Wow. Big statement. Wow. Wow.
Hot take.
Yeah, I think we should talk about that at some point, because mulliganing, I think is one of the bigger holes in my game, at least when I've played, like, GPs and stuff for a whole day. A lot of the games I lose, I feel like, came down to a mulligan decision, either not mulling a hand and then not drawing what I needed, or mulliganing and then drawing into more bad hands. And, you know, it's important not to be results-oriented, because if a hand is bad, you're supposed to mull it no matter what, even if it means you draw an even worse six. But I still just feel like it's a big hole for me, and I don't know how to patch it. And I do think that it's interesting how it applies to Cube. But that's a topic for another day, Anthony.
It also obviously depends on the cube as well. My own primary cube plays a lot more like Limited, and I think in that context, you're punished a lot more for just, you know, being down a card, and not punished as much for just, you're not going to get beaten down by as aggressive a deck. So I think it really does just fall upon the spectrum.
Yeah. We'll talk about mulliganing maybe on a future episode, but that's not what this episode is about. On this episode, I want to talk about a recent update I made to my cube and use that as an introduction to talk a little bit about fast mana and return to tempo, which is one of our most downloaded episodes from the past, is our episode on tempo. So I think it's a topic people are interested in. And I think it's very connected to fast mana, and it's very connected to mulliganing, Anthony, because, you know, people will say that in some formats, tempo doesn't really matter that much, but in pretty much every format of Magic, people are choosing to play first and not draw, which tells me that tempo does, in fact, matter pretty significantly, if that's the default assumption.
Yeah, I think that's a really good connection to make. Like, it seems like a different thing, but it's absolutely related to that.
But before we get to our main conversation, we are going to do a listener-submitted Pack 1, Pick 1. And this week, we are doing a cube from listener John. John sent us his 360-card cube, and this is a cube that John says in his email, and I don't think this is a typo, he says he has never played Magic with anyone but his wife thanks to the coronavirus, which would imply to me that John got into playing Magic within the last 12 months, maybe 13 months. And the cube list here is pretty extensive for somebody that is that new to the game, so very impressive there, John. John almost always grid drafts with his wife, so we're going to try and do a grid-drafted pack from John's 360-card cube. This is maybe a little bit difficult to do in audio because we are not just picking a single card. We are discussing which of these rows and columns we'll be taking. but I think we're going to give it a shot and see how it goes. And if it's completely impossible to follow, let us know by sending us an email or commenting on one of the various places on social media where this episode will be posted. Quick refresher for anybody that does not know what grid drafting is. Grid drafting is a form of drafting that is most often used for two players, and it's an entirely face-up draft format, so all these cards are face-up on the table. We can see what our opponent is taking at all times, they can see what we're taking, and what happens is the cards are arranged in a 3x3 grid, so 9 cards per pack, and what we're going to do is lay them out in a grid and then alternate taking a row or a column, just horizontal or vertical, not diagonal, from that grid. Once some combination of two rows or columns are taken, we'll discard the remaining 3 or 4 cards and move on to the next pack. So, this grid is as follows. The top row is Demonic Tutor, Arbor Elf, Gurmag Angler. Middle row, Solemn Simulacrum, Evolving Wilds, Knight of the Eben Legion. And the bottom row, Sulphurous Springs, Watery Grave, and Chain Lightning. And of course, any of those columns we could also take. So, Anthony, what is jumping out at you from this grid?
So grid draft is really one of my favorite ways, probably actually my favorite way to do a two-player draft format. I think we should definitely do a whole episode, if not entirely on grid draft, on two-player formats. What I really like about it is that a lot of ways to draft with two players end up trying to just like add this extra layer of hidden information to try and replicate that aspect of an 8-player draft pod. And grid draft just says, no, let's eliminate all those complexities, which end up with this weird metagame. And instead, let's just embrace that it is a face-up draft format. It's public information. Both players know what the other is doing. And I think that does lead to different strategies ending up shining a little bit more. Specifically, I think it's very hard to draft aggressive decks in a grid draft. Obviously, if this is a cube designed to be grid drafted, things can be warped to sort of balance that out. But in general, an aggressive deck ends up doing much worse, I think, in a lot of formats in games 2 and 3, because your opponent knows what you're doing, they can sideboard really well against it. And in grid draft, you're starting out with public information. So if your opponent sees you starting to take a bunch of aggressive one drops, they can really easily start taking cards to pick against that. So what I'm looking at going into this is not going to try and get super aggressive, probably. And also, I'm going to be totally willing to hate draft. It's a zero-sum game in this case. I'm not trying to collaborate with the people next to me on my pod. I want to take the best cards from my opponent. So I think where that leads me is I'm definitely going to take Demonic Tutor, which is in our first slot, which means we can take a row or a column with either Arbor Elf and Gurmag Angler, or Solemn Simulacrum and Sulphurous Springs. I think I'm leaning towards the Solemn Simulacrum and Sulphurous Springs, just because it's two good, solid fixing cards. How do you feel about that?
I like your analysis. I also really like grid drafting. It is not just my favorite two-player way to play Magic, but there was definitely a time where I would have maybe called it my favorite way to play Magic, period. Drafting with a full 8 players is great, but there's a lot of little practical things that come up there. Like, it is hard to get 8 people organized to play in paper. And even if you do it, then there is waiting between rounds if somebody's round is taking too long, and it just, you might draft a deck you don't love and you got to play 3 rounds of it. Grid drafting is great because you're sitting down with one player, you can draft very quickly and play a match and then just draft again. You know, like in the same time that I might be able to draft once and play 3 rounds with 7 other players, I might be able to get 3 separate grid drafts in with one other player. And there's something just really exciting to me. Like that just feels like a very well spent, 2 hours, 3 hours of playing Magic if you can get that much drafting and playing in as opposed to a full draft. But really great way to play Magic.
The other secret upside to a grid draft is that I think really is something that you enjoy, is that unlike a normal draft, it is public information, so you can just, if you want, talk about your picks, and we are people that love the social aspect of the game, so that can be a lot of fun.
You put that very generously. You're basically like, hey, Blabbermouth, you can't shut up. You love the sound of your own voice so much that you started a Magic podcast, so we know that you just want to talk about what you're taking, but that is true. Like, the actual, the closed information pack draft is a much less social experience than talking about what's in front of you. It's also really great to do a grid draft with a player who's maybe not familiar with the cube, maybe a little less enfranchised overall, because if they want to, they can say, like, hey, what's the best card in this pack? And you can tell them and give them your answer without having to compromise the draft, basically.
It doesn't mean they should listen to you necessarily.
Right. You could of course, throw them a... Yeah, you could, of course, throw a wrench into their plans by giving them some bad information, but you wouldn't do that. You're a nice person. You mentioned that you think aggro is weaker in a grid draft or harder to put together in a grid draft than a regular draft. And I agree, but I don't think it's for the reason that you mentioned. I think overall it's much harder in a grid draft to make a synergistic deck come together where you have very little flexibility for what each slot can do. So in an aggro deck, you really can't afford any cards that are off strategy, right? Like all of your cards need to be aggro cards. You can't just put in a five drop that has minimal impact on the board. You can't just put in a board wipe. You can't just put in some conditional card. Like the way the deck works is by being hyper consistent and having all of the cards in the deck be somewhat fungible in the sense that they're all trying to attack your opponent's life total or remove threats or whatever. And so really, an aggro deck to me is just a very broad synergistic deck. And that is hard to make work in grid draft, I think, because of the nature of the picks. You know, you end up with a lot of somewhat incidental picks in grid draft. As you mentioned here when you were evaluating this grid, you're like, well, Demonic Tutor is the best card in this grid. I agree with you. You're saying, I'm going to take that card no matter what, so I'm going to take one of these other rows or columns. And so really, your pick from this pack is Demonic Tutor, and then you're going to get two other cards, and you're deciding which other cards you want based on all the information available, obviously, but you don't get to take Demonic Tutor, Knight of the Eben Legion, and Gurmag Angler, right? Because they're not in the same row or column. So you end up, over the course of the grid draft, getting a lot of incidental picks, which means that it's very hard to have 23, 24, 25 non-land cards that are all feeding one specific synergy. And so for that reason, I think that...
No, you're totally right. I think both of those factors have just a huge influence on the shape of the game. So that's why I really like taking these kinds of flexible cards where I know I'm going to end up, because I'm taking three cards at a time, I can't take the best card every single pick. Having these kinds of flexible cards that are going to help me smooth out my deck, smooth out my mana, are really things that I'm prioritizing.
Yeah, exactly. To that end, I agree that Demonic Tutor is the standout card from this pack, and it's great all the time, right? It's just cycling, but draw the exact card you want instead of, you know, having to draw a card at random, which is really great.
Pretty good cantrip.
Pretty good cantrip, Demonic Tutor. But to put that aside for a moment, I think the other row that is appealing to me is the row of Sulphurous Springs, Water Grave, and Chain Lightning, and that's just two fixing lands that share a color, black, and then Chain Lightning, which is a great efficient removal spell that plays at all stages of the game. And I think there is some merit to looking at that row, because I do find that because you are getting a lot of incidental picks in grid draft, playing a three or four color deck or a three color deck with a splash can oftentimes be very rewarding, because you get later in the packs and, you know, as the draft goes on, your opponent will have kind of staked out some territory. And if you've instead staked out all the territory your opponent is not playing and just said, any card you don't take, I can potentially put in my deck and beat you with it, that means that you have a lot more potential power in later packs. And so taking the two best fixing lands out of this pack, because I'm not super high on Evolving Wilds in a format with Demonic Tutor and Chain Lightning and stuff, is not a bad place to be, but I can't pass up Demonic Tutor either. And I think I agree with you in taking the Demonic Tutor, Psalm Simulacrum, Sulphurous Springs column, because of that reason, basically. Because, you know, like you said, Demonic Tutor, best card in the pack, very flexible, goes in any deck that can cast it. And then Psalm Simulacrum and Sulphurous Springs, both perfectly serviceable fixing cards, which will, again, allow us to stake out that, hey, don't pass me any good cards because I'll play them position.
I will give a shout out to Knight of the Eben Legion. So we're saying if we drafted the exact same cube in an A-player pod versus grid draft, we expect the decks to be on average a little bit slower, but you're still going to have the fastest deck in that experience. And Knight of the Eben Legion is an extremely flexible card that is great on turn one, but does stuff later in the game as well. So I think if there wasn't the Demonic Tutor in the pack, I might be looking to try and fit that into my pick.
Knight is great. It's a card, when it was spoiled, I remember thinking, like, yeah, this is probably good enough to test out in my, like, mono-black aggro package. I was like, I wish it had two power instead of one. Like, I wish they switched his power and toughness, but it's probably good enough. And then over time, it's just, every time I play it, I'm more and more impressed by it. And now I think it's, without question, the best aggro one-drop in black, and it's not even close. So a card's really, really good. I continue to be really impressed by it.
It's very rude. I actually didn't know about the snuff out combo and was playing against it this last week, and my opponent snuffs out my creature, goes to the end step and says, trigger, put a counter on this. And I'm like, what's going on here?
<Uh-oh>.
I haven't lost any life.
Yeah, nothing quite as devastating as you're on the play, you like open on a mana dork or something, then your opponent plays Knight of the Eben Legion, snuffs out your mana dork and has a 2/3 in play on turn one and removed your creature. It's pretty rough.
I was jealous.
Also works with Dismember. There's other places where it comes up too. It's a pretty good card. All right, that's our grid. Anthony, I've thrown a wrench into your life. You very generously spent some time building a pack one, pick one page for the podcast episodes based on a piece of feedback we got on the subreddit. And here I've gone and given you a grid, which I don't think that page currently supports. So good luck updating that to support a grid draft pick. That's, you know, what can I say? Like, I like to make your life
difficult. I wasn't going to mention it, but that's just one more thing to add to my Sunday.
I can actually help you do that. I can take care of that one. You've been doing so much for the website recently. All right, John, thank you for sending in your cube. I think that grid draft was understandable from a listener perspective, but if I'm wrong and that was impossible to follow and you'd like us to never do it ever again, please let us know. You can also send us your cube so we can do a pack one, pick one on the air. Just send it to mail@luckypaper.co and include your name and pronouns, and we'll put it on our list. Anthony, we're in a weird position in that I made a pretty substantial update to my cube this past week in anticipation of our Wednesday night cube drafts with our local play group. And then I had something come up and was unable to play in that Wednesday night draft, but you did. So you are the only, you have played my cube since these big updates, and I have not, which is a weird spot because usually I would always be playing my own cube if it was being played. So I want to talk about these changes I made to my cube, but I think this will also parlay into a conversation about fast mana and tempo, which is something I've been wanting to come back to for a while. But in a nutshell, this big update to my cube was really just two things. I added a lot more fixing lands, so I added a whole nother cycle of fetch lands and a whole nother cycle of shock lands, bringing my main cube to 20 fetches, two cycles of fetches, and then three cycles of shock lands, so 50 fixing lands just from those, plus other fixing lands. And I also added a few more pieces of fast mana. Specifically, I upgraded Basalt Monolith to Grim Monolith, added Mox Diamond, Lotus Petal, Jeweled Amulet, and Dark Ritual to go along with some of the other fast mana already in my cube. It sounded like you maybe didn't have the most fun time with your deck and this particular draft. Again, I was not there, but I read through some of the messages in the Discord, and I was curious to know what you thought about these changes in just in the first draft you had to play with them.
So after this first draft, unfortunately, I just have a lot more questions than I do answers. We've definitely
questions lead to good conversation on a podcast. That's perfect.
Oh, really? I shouldn't just like state a couple good facts and we can move on?
I don't think that's what most people are listening for.
All right, so let's see if I can get my thoughts together about this. We've talked a lot in the past about how better fixing doesn't necessarily just enable the five color nonsense decks or, you know, whatever the kind of multicolor decks you might expect to see in the format. It really enables every kind of deck, including the aggressive decks. And the fact that an aggressive deck has access to more different colors, more different cards of different power levels, it actually balances that out. I'm not sure if that's still the case anymore. I wonder if you've actually added enough fixing where the aggressive decks actually can't really profit off that anymore, or if I really need to sort of change the way that I approach drafting this cube and actually just say, like, yeah, I can draft a two-color aggressive deck now and really try and maximize the power of both of those colors and actually keep a proactive deck that can compete with the really greedy decks.
I gotta say, I was very surprised to see the deck list from this draft because these changes were public. We talked about how I was adding a bunch more fixing lands, and the decks drafted were mono-green, basically mono-green, splashing for, like, two blue cards, mono-red, mono-black, again, splashing for, like, a red card, maybe two red cards, mono white, and then a blue white control list and a like four or five color like greed pile. So six drafters, and that was the breakdown of the decks. So it was a really weird breakdown because four essentially mono colored decks were drafted. Again, a couple of those were splashing a card or two, but could have easily been fully mono colored if they wanted to. They just, and actually, that was an interesting, I thought, example of, I think a lot of those decks, if I hadn't increase the density of fixing, might have made the assessment that it was not worth the risk to splash for those cards they were splashing for and just played a worse monocolored card to fill out their list. But they each had some incidental fetch lands and shock lands and were like, sure, it's worth it for me to splash this card in my otherwise monocolored deck. And then we did have a blue-white control, and then, yeah, a full, like, classic 4-5 color nonsense deck that, you know, is exactly in the category of 4-5 color nonsense decks we've talked about before on the podcast.
I think a lot of that also has to do not so much with the current list of the cube, but there's a lot of sort of metagame and expectations that these players who have drafted the cube a number of times before kind of expect it to play out. So I think there's going to be a lot of recalibration that needs to happen. The other big thing that I noticed, I don't want to say which specific deck I played because it was not a good deck. We'd ever need to share it. I wasn't just splashing for a couple off-color cards because I thought they were worth it. I ended up just really, really struggling to hit playables. Even though no one else was anywhere close to the lane I was in, I just didn't have enough cards. And I feel like that's another not necessarily negative, but I think another feature of adding this much fixing to a cube is people just ended up with a lot less non-land cards to work with. So I ended up taking a lot of lands fairly highly and then not being able to fully utilize them, and just didn't end up with a deck that had as much power. And I feel like that's where potentially the diminishing margins of the aggressive deck kind of end up panning out, that I would have rather just been in a deck that was playing a lot more colors to be able to take advantage of the larger card pool I would have access to.
Yeah, I'm looking at your list now, so you... We won't save the deck if we don't want to, but you...
just picture a deck that's not very good.
You're splashing two off-color cards, so you're essentially... You're one of the monocolor decks. You are splashing two cards that are not in your deck's colors. You have two cards in your sideboard that are your deck's main color, but are very off-strategy, and then you have, like, a colorless card that you could potentially play that would not be great in this particular deck strategy, but would at least be playable if you really felt it was not worth it to splash. So you could have played like an extra land and a pretty suspect but playable colorless card instead of splashing these two off-color cards. I think you made the right evaluation for the pool you had. And I agree. So what you're describing, this tension, is the exact sort of design space that made me add more fixing. So what I came to the conclusion of is, we've talked before about how we've both increased the number of lands in our cube over time and have never really looked back. Every time we add more lands, it's like, yeah, this feels better. And I admittedly, I'm pushing the envelope here with the number of lands I added in this one shot is a lot. And if ever I was going to overshoot and end up in a place where the cube does actually play negatively because of the increase of lands, this would be it. But the reason I decided to do it was really just crunching some numbers around what I'm using the sideboard slots for. So the cards that you draft that don't end up in your main deck, I feel like that's a very important design space that is not very well articulated by cube designers. What I mean is that, like, we talked about this on the show before, where there's a couple ways you can activate this space. You can activate it by, as I'm doing, adding more fixing, which means that, on average, most players will basically not be sideboarding very many cards that were on strategy for their deck. Because every time you have a card that is perfectly fine, works in your strategy, is in your colors, but just is the 24th best card, 25th best card, if we just imagine that in that same draft, that was another fixing land you could play, then your deck would be better at no cost, right? Because you're not playing that 25th best card anyway, and so you don't have more fixing means you get to just make your deck better.
Another way to say that is just that you're allowing players to have more of the cards they draft actually end up in their deck, right?
Right, which effectively decreases the size of sideboards because you're right. Going to play more cards you draft. And it also means that there is a tension now between, like, making sure you get enough playables, which historically, right. One of the things people say about Cube is that, like, oh, you're just always flush with playables, right? You don't have to worry about getting the playables, and that's, like, not even a concern anymore. And one thing I like to do with my Cube is, like, challenge these overarching assumptions about, you know, what types of cards are good or what Cube has to be. And the idea that you're always flush with playables, to me, just seems like missed opportunity. Like, it's wasted design space if you are sideboarding a bunch of otherwise playable cards. It's like, that could be other stuff that contributed to the draft in some other interesting way. Another thing that we talked about before, just to restate it, is that, like, you again have two cards in your main color that are in the sideboard just because they're extremely different in terms of their strategy. That's another, I think, very valuable way to use that space. So if you're going to have cards that you can't play in the sideboard, make sure they're actually cards that would contribute to a very different strategy, not just cards that are worse versions of the cards you're already running. Then you're at least providing some flexibility and diversity for how those decks can potentially play out. Given your deck, I can't imagine a world where you would side into either of those cards, but you could have drafted this same color very differently and actually played those cards to your advantage if you had wanted to go down a different route. So that's a cool way to use that space too. There's also obviously...
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about that before. Basically, like, having synergy in the draft means, even though a lot of cards will end up in sideboards and not be played in any given game, it means that in some drafts you might end up, because you have card A, card B, which would have ended up in a sideboard in one draft, will end up in your main deck in another, which means that in the draft portion, a lot of those picks still matter. And it's not just, oh, it's my 24th card that's never going to make my main deck if I have 23 other cards I like more than it.
It's also how you encode, like, more depth into the draft, so that if you end up drafting the same color three times in a row, it doesn't mean you have the same deck three times in a row, because right. That color has a lot of flexibility, and so you don't just have 10 possible two-color decks, because each of those two colors could possibly be drafted in different ways. You know, you could have a blue-white tempo deck or a hard blue-white control deck. Those are both blue-white card pools. There's a lot of overlap in the cards those decks will play, but the cards that are different, that differentiate those strategies with their small number of slots, add a whole other possible deck to be drafted, which is a cool,
right,
a cool way to basically increase the depth of what you're doing in your draft.
But in this particular draft, and I don't want to, again, make any commitments, because I think that I have a lot to learn about drafting this cube now in this state, and I already had a lot to learn about it before this change. It felt extremely tight. Like, I didn't feel like I had very much wiggle room. It felt like a lot of my picks were fairly prescriptive, because I just sort of had to take the on-theme card. I didn't really have any opportunities to speculate, is what I guess I'm feeling, because the actual number of non-land cards that were going to end up in my pool was so small compared to, you know, a draft with a lot fewer lands.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to mention about that is that that is certainly affected by the fact that it was only a six-player draft, and I don't know...
That's also true, yeah.
I don't know how to calibrate, like, most of the decisions I make around my cube are calibrated to this idealized vision of an eight-player draft, which my cube is a 360-card cube. It's designed to be drafted for eight players, fundamentally, but obviously I draft it in lots of other ways. I grid draft it, we play with six players, we do other kinds of draft formats all the time, and so I would like to still optimize for that idealized, perfect eight-player draft, but I don't want to do so in such a way that it makes a big sacrifice for other kinds of draft formats. And this could be an example of a change that actually works really well with eight players, but the impacts are much more strongly felt in like a six-player draft. The other thing that could happen is we could end up learning, and again, I haven't even drafted this cube yet since making these changes, we could end up learning that when you're in a six-player draft and you know there's a lot of fixing in the environment, that you actually maybe should avoid consciously the monocolored decks, because you know that even if you identify a completely open lane and no one else is taking green or red cards or whatever, there are going to be less opened, and so you might not get as many as you want for your very clear, like, straightforward strategy. And also you're just going to have a again kind of more incidental picks, like, the because it's a smaller card pool and a smaller number of players at the table, you're going to get more powerful cards in other colors and strategies later in the packs, and so just being able to cast them and kind of cobble together a more grid draft style, good stuffy deck is maybe the best way to draft with fewer people. And so there's all kinds of moving targets there, and I'm not sure how that's going to shake out once we have more experience drafting with these higher density of lands and also with different numbers of people and whatnot.
What I do think is really interesting, and I value about this, and I'm curious maybe if this is still part of your philosophy, but I know especially when you were initially designing this cube and taking a lot of influence from the Magic Online cubes, you were seeing that the way that those played out, draft in, draft out, was you didn't really need to take the 6 and 7 mana cards. Like, you'll get some big expensive bomb, and you only need so many in your deck. So those cards ended up being really, really undervalued, or under, what's the way to describe it? You just didn't need to take them highly. And
right. Even if they're really powerful cards, like, you often hear people say, like, I'm not going to start on a 6-mana finisher. There's a million 6-mana finishers in cube. Why would I bother taking one now when I know I'm going to wheel 6 of them later on in this draft?
Exactly. So you made a very conscious decision to say, well, let's actually, if there are too many of them, try and tune all of these different aspects, all these different kinds of effects, all these different costs, so that things are more in balance and you will need to take them highly, because it is exist in an appropriate volume in the environment compared to how many you actually want in your deck. And the fetch lands is definitely something that is an extremely high pick and kind of felt very obvious and natural, and no one was going to criticize you for saying, like, well, I have to take fetch lands highly, so that's counter to your philosophy. But it definitely was, and having this experience where I could say, well, fixing's not the most important thing anymore, I know I can get some of it later, I think is potentially more in line with your philosophy, and ultimately I think might work out really well.
You've mentioned this before, and fixing is one of these weird things where this came up in our rotisserie draft of your cube especially, where because it's an effect that pretty much every deck at the table is going to want, and when you have fetch lands and 5-color fixing lands and stuff, those cards can be played in lots of different decks. It is even more pronounced than other kinds of cards, the kind of thing where it just comes down to what the table agrees the point you have to take fixing right. is. And what I really would love to dial in, and I think this is not any kind of objective or global truth or anything, but I'd like to dial in for our playgroup the point where players that value fixing can take it a little higher than everyone else, and players that don't value fixing can take it a little lower, but it's not universally accepted across everybody that, like, oh, we take fixing at this point, right? And in many cubes, it is widely accepted that, like, yeah, you take fetch lands early for all the reasons we've talked about in all of our pack one pick ones. Why we like taking fetch lands early? They're powerful, they're flexible, they're very open. You know, it's a very strong card to take early. But yeah, if there's 20 of them, or 30 of them, or 40 of them, is it still that important? Or I mean, at some point, obviously, fetch lands have diminishing returns. The first fetch land is worth a ton because it doubles all of your shock lands, it turns on all of your colors. The second fetch land is worth quite a bit less because it's just, you know, another version of that same effect. And then I think the 10th fetch land is maybe actively detrimental because now you have too many fetches and you won't be able to turn on your late game fetches to actually still find lands in your deck to fetch up with them. And so there is this graph of diminishing returns to it. And I think the more you add, the more you're playing with this sense of your players of when they need to actually prioritize these in the draft. And I'd like to find a sweet spot where some people in our group think that, yeah, there's enough here that I don't have to prioritize them. And some people still think, yeah, I do have to prioritize this because it's that important to me. That disagreement, that contradiction, or, you know, basically like players evaluating things differently is, I think, one of my highest design principles. I want my cube to play such that people disagree on pack one, pick ones, disagree on when things should be taken, because I think that means that we're in an interesting space where people are not just doing the prescribed thing or the thing that the group has agreed upon as the prescribed thing, and instead are just doing what they think is best, and that differs from other people.
Yeah, what's appealing to me about what you just described is I think that there can be kind of a feast or famine effect with the amount of fixing that is often played in cubes, where if some players are saying, yeah, I'm going to take these fixing lands first and second in a pack, and others are saying, well, I'm maybe going to take it like sixth, some players will just never see it. But if we turn up the volume a little bit, I can see a world where it's still like people can have fixing so that they can make functional decks. But the players that really want to prioritize it in order to do certain things with it have that opportunity without just like completely nuking everybody else's draft.
Yeah. Anyway, looking at your draft pool, I'll bleep this, but I think you could have been full. You've got two sitting here in the sideboard. You've got a. I think you could have gone a little harder into just many colors and just see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that two-color aggro decks, well, maybe that's a too broad of a term, but, you know, I play mostly limited if I'm not playing cube, and just drafting a two-color proactive deck in limited is a lot of fun, and I think I would enjoy if two-color aggressive decks in this cube can also be viable, so I'm definitely going to have more of an open mind about that in the future.
The other thing I wanted to talk about then, Anthony, is I want to talk a little bit about fast mana, because in addition to adding these 20 more fixing lands to my cube, I added or upgraded these 5 fast mana cards. Fast mana is one of the most interesting effects to me in cube. I want to start by following up a little bit. So listener Sky had, I think, some really great feedback on our previous episode about power delta and power disparity, which, you know, we can never talk about every aspect of a topic whenever we do it on the show, but I think a very important aspect of power level band that we didn't touch on at all was, you know, we talked a lot about how having a wider power level band affects your draft in way X, and having it be narrower makes your drafts play out differently, but there's another very important factor of that, which is the density of effects at the extremities of that power level band. So, for example, if you have a pretty wide power level band, but there's only like 2 or 3 cards in the entire cube that are at that extreme, that are like the most powerful cards, that are set off from the other most powerful cards in the cube, that, I think, leads to more toxic and negative gameplay and draft patterns than if you had, for example, 20 cards that were all very, very powerful and very big standouts from the cube, because when you only have 3, it really is just luck whether you get one of them, right? And if you get 2 of them, then you're extremely lucky. You open 2 of the, you know, let's say you instead of power 9, we have power 3. You just have 3 Black Lotuses in your cube, and the rest of it is your normal regular cube, Anthony. Now, if you just have a Black Lotus, you're just hugely advantaged. And if you open 2 Black Lotuses, then you're like just blessed, and your opponents are going to be just having a very bad day. But if you had 20 Black Lotuses, now on average, like, players are going to get a couple Black Lotuses, right? Like, everybody's going to have a couple of these things, which means that you're moving some of that variance from the draft to the gameplay, because obviously whether you draw your Black Lotuses or not is a new factor. But you are also evening the playing field a little bit, even though you're still playing with a really wide power level band of cards. Does that hold true for you? Do you think it makes sense?
Do you think it actually reduces variance like that, or does it just change people's perceptions? Because you don't see, oh, well, I just lost because my opponent has a Black Lotus, but instead you're thinking, well, I sure hope I draw my Black Lotus next game and be the one to be able to do that.
I think it does decrease variance. We could maybe ask Jet to do a bunch of modeling on this, but first of all, the fact that you only get three pack one pick ones, I think, is a big factor here. Again, if we're assuming a normal 3x15 style draft. If there's only three cards that are huge power level standouts, they're not likely to be in the same pack with one another, and whoever opens them is going to take them. And so you're never, ever getting past power. You have no chance to get it if you don't get it pack one, pick one, pretty much. Once there's 20 of these cards that are huge power level outliers, then you will at some point be past some of these things, right? Like, just statistically, like, they're going to be in the same packs as one another. Some player's going to open a pack with three of them, and they're not going to be able to take all three, and then they just take one, and then more players get some of that passed around. So I think it decreases variance in that way, and I think the other way it decreases variance is that, again, if there's only three powerful cards in the entire cube, a game where player A draws and plays their powerful card early in the game, if we're assuming these are huge power level outliers, just be over, right? Let's assume that's a non-game because I just used a Black Lotus and I played a four drop on turn one and you had no chance, right? Now, all of those would-be non-games have the potential to be answered by your opponent doing exactly the same thing. And essentially, again, if we're assuming these power outliers are at least similar in power level, offsetting your broken play with their own broken play, and now you're back at square one, right? You turn one, play a four drop with a Black Lotus. I turn one, play a four drop with a Black Lotus. Now you've both spent our very powerful card, and we're still even on card advantage, on tempo, on everything. So I think for those two reasons, having more of the broken stuff does actually decrease variance. And I think the thing you're describing is also very real. Even if it decreases variance not that dramatically, it also adds this factor of like, well, at least I know I have the chance to do that, where I don't even have the chance if I don't have one of these powerful cards.
I'm skeptical. I feel like it doesn't actually reduce the variance, but it does increase the complexity a lot, and that sort of opportunity for things to be balanced out by multiple broken cards. I don't know. I think that I agree with the result, but I'm not sure I agree it actually, like, numerically would reduce variance.
Jet, if you're listening, you gotta get on this statistical analysis. Let's let's do some modeling and assume a cube where, you know, you have 340 five level power cards and, you know, 20 10 level power cards, and do the same thing with different numbers of powerful cards. I want to see how that pans out. Maybe we could find some sweet spot, some perfect number of power outliers that can actually minimize the variance as much as possible in the games and draft while still playing with big power level outliers. Anyway, whether or not that's true, it feels true to me. When Sky mentioned it, I was like, yeah, I think that is a point that we missed that is a very important consideration when you're considering your power level ban, because I do think it's different, even if we don't agree on how it's different. I think it's different that if you have a wide power level ban, but only like one or two outliers versus, 20 or 30 power level outliers, I think it plays very differently. And that made me reflect on my own cube, where I don't aim for a flat power level. I am happy playing some cards that are better than other cards. And a lot of the cards I play that are on the power level outlier side of things are some form of fast mana, stuff like Gaia's Cradle, stuff like Ancient Tomb, those kinds of cards that can provide a huge tempo swing with a single card, which I like because in my environment, I'm not playing combo, I'm not playing what I deem to be unfair strategies, and that's a kind of fluffy term, but what I mean by that is that, like, I want all the decks in my cube to have to care about what their opponent is doing. And when I see people play Storm or something in the Magic Online Vintage Cube, I see them constantly saying, like, well, it doesn't matter what our opponent does. We just have to care about whether our deck gets to do its unfair thing, and then we ignore our opponent until we get to go off. And what I want to avoid is any of that. I want it to be very interactive. I want all the decks to have to care about what other decks are doing. And so that's what I consider, like, a fair deck, where you have to care what your opponent is up to. And because I'm only enabling those fair decks, I found the fast mana to actually be really fun and interesting, because it's not like I play this fast mana and it just lets me combo off on turn one and my opponent never had a chance. It just affects the tempo of the game in a very direct way that lets me offset the downside of being on the draw, or lets me capitalize on an opponent stumbling by doing something at a very high tempo. So Vitcher is a couple of cards that I've avoided for years because I felt like they would be too big of power outliers. And those cards are like Grim Monolith and Mox Diamond, specifically are the two that, I've thought about for a long time. I like those cards a lot, but I was worried they would just be power outliers that decided games. But I had this reflection moment of being like, well, I'm already running Ancient Tomb, and I'm already running City of Traitors, and I'm already running Gaia's Cradle. And like, those cards kind of do exactly the same thing. And so why only have three of them when I can have six of them or whatever? Like, I feel like having more of them just increases the potential that your opponent could also have a high tempo play to make up for the fact that you were down on tempo. But Anthony, my feeling is, you know, Anthony Maddox, defender of low power cards, my feeling is you probably don't like these kinds of swingy, fast mana cards in the category of like Dark Ritual, Ancient Tomb, Lotus Petal, Grim Monolith. And I'm curious to hear if that's true, if that is actually the case, if you don't like the play patterns of these cards, and if it is, why?
You're totally right. And the reasons are a couple. Part of it is just like, yeah, the sort of high variance play of you play your Dark Ritual and you stick an unbeatable threat and now I can't win. That's just not a fun interactive game of Magic to me. And conversely, if you're playing in a format where those are not particularly powerful, where those are actually balanced by, you know, somebody has the efficient removal to counter the Phyrexian Obliterator you played on turn two or whatever, then it also isn't really that fun to play with because it's just like a huge risk investment of saying, well, either I win if this sticks or I lose if it doesn't. So that's generally where I'm at.
Hold on, just one second. You've defended Baneslayers on this show for the exact same reason. You've said before that you think Baneslayers are interesting because they do represent a risk and you have to figure out when to cast them and find the right moment to take that risk and capitalize on it. What's the difference between the risk of tapping out for a 5-mana huge threat that doesn't affect the board immediately and dies to removal and hoping your opponent doesn't have removal versus tapping your Grim Monolith on turn 3 to try and play a 5-drop and hoping your opponent doesn't have the answer for it?
The difference is all this fast mana is effectively card disadvantage. You're spending multiple cards in order to get your creature in play, and if that fails, not only are you down a card, you're kind of out of luck in your whole game plan.
That's funny, because that's the exact reason why I'm drawn to the fast mana cards, because...
So you don't like Baneslayers, but you do like double Baneslayers.
Well, it is a different axis, right? Like, the cost of running quote-unquote Baneslayers, and... You know, there's all kinds of definition for Baneslayers, but in this case, let's talk about actual Baneslayer Angel. You're playing a 5-mana threat that if you get to combat with it, it's going to gain you a bunch of life, it's going to be near impossible for anything to block it profitably, and it's just going to take over the game as soon as you get to stick it for a couple turns. The risk of that card is a tempo risk, because you're going to spend 5 mana on this threat, and then your opponent could just unsummon it, or Doomblade it, spend 1 or 2 mana to completely negate all of that mana you invested. And so what you're down there is tempo. You're not down cards, because you traded 1 for 1 on cards. You played a card, they played a card, and now you're back at square one. But you are down on tempo, which is a cost. I think that for the same reason those cards are interesting, it's interesting to play in the other space of saying, like, when is the time where it's right for me to risk these cards for a tempo advantage? And that's what these fast mana cards are, right? What you're doing is you're turning extra cards in your hand into faster board development than you would otherwise be allowed to have, in the way that, like, really broken fast mana, like Moxes, for example, is no card disadvantage. Moxes are just a land. You get to play whenever you want, right? So there's no card disadvantage right there. You're even on cards, and you're ahead on tempo, which I think is not a fun trade-off. Whereas if you look at something like Lotus Petal is the cleanest example, right? Lotus Petal is a Mox that just dies after you use it, and so you're trading a whole card to be ahead on your board development for one turn. And I just, you know, tempo remains one of the aspects of the game that I'm most interested in, and I want to play in that space more, and I feel like it's fun to decide when the moment to use your Lotus Petal is. I will agree that these cards are fundamentally very swingy, and the most basic way you can look at it is that in your opening hand, a Lotus Petal is what a Lotus Petal is. It's just, you know, decide which turn you want to take a turn ahead and, you know, get this tempo advantage and then sequence your plays such that you get the most value out of it. When you draw a Lotus Petal on turn 7, it's just an awful land. It's a really, really bad basic land that, you know, maybe you have some kind of non-creature spell synergy or something and get a little bit of value off of it. But for the most part, it's just a bad basic land. And that's true of a lot of these fast mana cards. Top decking a Mox Diamond can be awful. If you've already played out all your lands, now it's a land you can't even play, which is pretty rough. So they're very swingy in that regard, but I think it's interesting to give decks access to this very direct tempo play and say, like, I think they're build-arounds more than people think they are. People oftentimes talk about these cards in very heightened terms, like they're just broken fast mana that any deck will play. I don't think that's the case. I think your deck has to either be committed to ending the game very quickly, some form of aggro deck where you're going to play Lotus Petal in place of a land, and you're just going to allow you to play a 3-drop a turn early and basically get your opponent dead that much faster, such that the card disadvantage is irrelevant to you. You don't care because your opponent's dead. Or you have to be using that fast mana to either recoup some lost tempo. Like, I can imagine a control deck that wouldn't normally want a Lotus Petal for the reasons we talked about, siding it in when their opponent is a hyper fast aggro deck to let them bore wipe a turn early, just so they, you know, save 9 life or whatever. And that's an interesting use of that fast mana too. Or you have to use it to invest it into something that's going to recoup that card disadvantage. So if you're using your Lotus Petal or Grim Monolith to rush out a big Planeswalker or something that is then going to generate virtual card advantage by being in play earlier and making tokens or whatever, then it's another way you can kind of cash in on that advantage. But that's why I'm interested in adding these cards, and I'm especially interested in doing it in the context of my cube being all quote-unquote fair strategies, because I oftentimes see these cards grouped with all of the unfair combo stuff that you see in powered cubes or in cubes that are doing reanimator or stuff like that, and that's where these cards seem to fit in more often. But I rarely see them being used to maximize fair strategies, and I'm curious to see how they will play out.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think there's a good reason for that. I think that people, you know, I think that the joke of calling them, like, it's even more extreme than a Baneslayer is kind of true, and people really want to play these in the context where they are doing something that wins the game on the spot, so it's not really playing that risk game. And I think the other thing you mentioned that's really important to be specific about is all power is not the same. There's a huge difference between the actual play patterns and the sort of like way that the Moxen and Black Lotus behave. The Mox are just pure variants. They're not a thing you build around. Like, maybe there's a tiny bit of tension if you want to argue about putting Mox Jet into your mono white aggro deck, where sometimes you end up not having enough white mana. But really, they're just like free variants you can sprinkle in if that's fun for you. Or, you know, to support specific archetypes like Storm. Whereas Black Lotus does come with a risk, and the more nerfed versions of it, more so because they're not just so broken you just want to play it all the time, that I think that they do play into a tension that, even though it's not the way I usually prefer to play Magic, it definitely plays into the sort of goals in the space that you're interested in exploring.
The other thing I'll say about some of these fast mana cards is, I feel like I learned this lesson from the Degenerate Micro Cube, because initially, there were a whole suite of cards that I initially assumed would be too good for the Degenerate Micro Cube. And again, I was trying to make it as degenerate as possible, but I was trying to avoid auto picks no matter what, because the drafts is very small in that environment. You only get 20 picks. So I didn't want to just put Moxen in, because every deck's going to take the Mox, and that's just one, that's 5% of your entire picks just, you know, forced on this dumb Mox that are not actually playing into your strategy at all. It's just giving you this free ramp or whatever. And I had initially grouped Sol Ring into this category of cards. I was like, any deck will take Sol Ring, it'll play it. It's just a forced pick. Like, it's dumb to include it in this environment because it's not actually giving my players a choice. But after playing it a bunch, I ended up adding it in because it turned out that in that environment, there's actually a lot of decks that don't want two generic mana. Like, it is not worth a card for two generic mana. You know, these really fast flash combo decks that are playing all of the free counter spells to back it up, they have nothing to spend two generic mana on. They just don't have it. Like, the most expensive card is one in a blue, and then the rest of their cards are casting for free or whatever. And that's true of a couple decks in that particular cube that just don't really want the two generic mana from Sol Ring, such that it actually becomes a build around, which sounds wild if you have only played Sol Ring in the context of 360 card singleton cubes. I'm hoping that I can push my cube to a place where Grim Monolith is the same kind of thing in my cube that Sol Ring is in the Degenerate Micro Cube. And so the cards I cut to make room for all this fast mana and more fixing were largely cards that cost 6 mana or more that I felt like were not necessary. They were kind of redundant win conditions for control or redundant mid-range threats that were just the worst versions of threats that, you know, you would play if you got them, but you didn't have anything better, but they weren't really adding anything unique or special to the draft environment. And those are specifically the cards that I would be worried about people rushing out with Grim Monolith. So the specific thing I've cited in the past for why I didn't want to run Grim Monolith is that I didn't want some random black deck to be able to play Grave Titan on turn 3, right? Because that's not really what black is supposed to do in my cube, and sometimes you'll just free roll it, and then it's a really, really difficult to answer threat that even if you remove the Grave Titan, there's still two zombies left over, and it's just a really, really tough thing to deal with. So, I mean, I've cut Grave Titan, I cut Inferno Titan, I cut a lot of these cards that I think would be the biggest problems if rushed out with Grim Monolith, such that at this point, the things you're spending Grim Monolith mana on are narrow enough that I think it's kind of a build around. Like, I don't think aggro decks in my environment want Grim Monolith. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think they do. And there's, you know, 3-ish aggro decks at every single draft of my cube. So it's like, all right, that's now 3 of the 8 decks that don't even want this card that I was worried was going to be too powerful. And I think it's a very interesting question. I mean, I think it's great in mid-range. I think mid-range decks are going to like it no matter what. And then it's interesting for me to think about what that will actually mean for control decks. What control decks will want Grim Monolith versus ones that won't? And I think that once you have like an Upheaval or something, then you really want Grim Monolith. Now it's kind of a build-around. Once you have Urza or other Artifact Matters payoffs or other reasons to go really, really big, then you care about this Grim Monolith. But the average, like, you know, blue-black control list with counterspells and cantrips and board wipes, I don't know if it's going to want Grim Monolith. And so I'm interested to see how that plays out, and I'm hoping I can kind of thread this needle of making this card really appealing and very powerful, but also not just a slam dunk in the vast majority of decks.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have some mixed feelings about some of those cuts, like Grave Titan, but that's not super important. For me, I think what's the important takeaway is that the reason these cards were excluded was not because of... Or it seemed like they were excluded for power level reasons, but really, one of your goals is not to try and curb the power level. You are trying to push the power level as much as possible. What you are trying to curb is, like, free picks that just go into every deck and don't have a lot of interesting decision space. And I think it's interesting that these cards actually do involve a lot of interesting decision space.
I also, you know, I do like to push the power level, and I think my reasons for playing at a high power level are largely that I feel like the increased pressure makes every decision that much more important. If you are playing in an environment where an aggro deck can run you over by turn three or four, you're under the pressure in the draft and in your deck building to find a deck that is not going to lose to that. Or if you know that you're in an environment where somebody can potentially use some of these fast mana cards to play something early, you are under that pressure to make sure you have a density of answers to a early powerful threat. And I like that pressure. I like what it does to the draft and the gameplay, that it really puts a lot of importance in all of your decisions. That said, I don't want these powerful cards to result in a higher density of non-games, where, like, I like the fact that an Ancient Tomb or a Grim Monolith can help you recoup the tempo disadvantage from being on the draw, but if you're on the play and you would already be at a tempo advantage, now you're at a further tempo advantage, is it just too much to come back from, and how often does that happen? And I don't know, and that's what I'm interested to learn from playing these cards. So that's the line I'm trying to toe, is I want these powerful cards to be active decisions you have to make in draft and deck building, and I don't want them to just, you know, lead to a dramatic increase in non-games, but we'll have to see how things play out.
Yeah, even though I agree they do support your goals, I do think they are necessarily adding more variance to the environment. So I don't totally agree with the decision to cut cards like Grave Titan on that specific balance, because ultimately it is like an interaction between a handful of cards. So it feels like it's going to change the environment more than you're intending.
Defend the Grave Titan for me for a moment here at the end of this podcast, because I'm curious to know why. It's a card I'm surprised to hear you miss specifically, given your proclivities for... Talk about a card that ends games. I mean, Grave Titan is a card that ends games, certainly more so than Grim Monolith will, I think, in a lot of situations. Grim Monolith doesn't actually do anything, but it lets you play other cards faster. Grave Titan ends almost any game it resolves in. Why do you like this card? Why do you miss it?
Here's my question. Why am I playing your cube? Sell me on it.
Wait, what the? You can't just turn this...
Well, one of the things that's appealing is I can play Grave Titan. Well, not anymore.
I mean, you could just sub in any other card for that, though. Some people don't like to play Grave Titan. Some people like to play Grim Monolith or whatever. I think
you're cutting out a big space that appeals to some Timmy players. And sometimes that is what I enjoy about. Like, I love my low-power cube where it's all about little dinky creatures. But yeah, having like that variability and being able to play a cube where I can play these like extremely powerful six drops that take over the game is another thing that I guess I'll just have to put it in a commander deck or something.
You can still play Ugin the Ineffable, or I still have Craterhoof Behemoth in there. You can do that kind of stuff if you want.
Interesting. So what's the difference between Grave Titan and Ugin?
Simply put, Ugin is a six drop that any other deck can play. I mean, any control deck, it's a colorless card is the answer. Like, I've looked at all my six drops and decided which ones to keep, and Ugin was one of the only ones that made the list because it was colorless, and because I think it is fundamentally much more flexible. Like, you have choices to make when you resolve Ugin that you do not have when you resolve Grave Titan. Your choice when you resolve Grave Titan is, gosh, I sure hope they don't have a board wipe or some kind of answer to this Grave Titan, because if they don't, I'm going to win the game in like two turns. Ugin, I think, is arguably equally powerful. I mean, it's hard to say because it's powerful in very different ways, but the fact that it does both pose additional deck building and drafting considerations with the static ability, which does come up in my environment, and then when you resolve it, you have to ask yourself this question of, do I want to commit to the board and make some tokens and eventually generate card advantage, or do I want to risk potentially a removal spell or a flying attacker or something and kill something with my Ugin? I think it just offers way more decision points than Grave Titan does.
That's interesting. Your defense makes sense. I think what I would counter that with is, in the same way we talked about how there are advantages to having a disparity in power level and actually like having some picks that are a little bit easier because you have a powerful card in the pack that lets you, that guides you in a certain direction, actually can add some satisfying moments and make a draft very enjoyable. I think in the same way, saying every single decision has to be a nail biter, there always has to be maximum complexity. Also, you can take a little bit too far, and just saying, well, sometimes if you want to just put a deck that has a Grave Titan in, and just cross your fingers and hope they don't have a board wipe, can also be a satisfying thing to make an option.
Well, now what you get to do is you get to play a Grim Monolith and play your Ugin on turn 3, and then cross your fingers and hope they don't have a Hero's Downfall. It's the same thing.
All right, I'll look forward to that.
That's it, friends, for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our magic is produced by DJ James Nasty. All of the magic cards are made by Wizards of the Coast. All of the listening is done by you, and all the talking is done by me, Andy Mangold, and my co-host, Anthony Maddox. Thank you for talking about magic with me, Anthony.
Thank you, Andy. It's been a pleasure. I think you did say all of our magic is produced by DJ James Nasty.
I said all of our magic?
I think so.
Jeez. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. There we go. Now I've got that.